Good evening. Whoa. Woke me up. Let's see if that's better. That's pretty good. You guys can hear me okay? Okay. Well, good evening, everybody. I have passed out 60 questions on the John chapter 18. Yeah, a little bit of overdrive today. We talked about chapter 17 and how significant chapter 17 is in the life of Jesus. Well, I don't think you could ever really top it, but you can top it because then you get to chapter 18. And chapter 17 shows the love that Christ has for us, for his people, for his Father. And chapter 18 is an action of those things. So 17 is his prayer to the Father and the intention of the heart and all the things that he is laying out before the disciples who are there with him and also with the Father. But then in 18, we see it in action. And this is really, really important because words don't mean anything if there's no action to back up those words, right? So we're going to get into that tonight. And again, I apologize because you know I'm going to forget that I have questions. So I get on a roll and I forget to go back to the questions. But I did give you the scriptures this time so you know which scriptures to go into. And we're going to look at a couple of things tonight that are sort of very poignant. And, of course, you guys know me well enough. One of the reasons we know they're poignant is because we're going to look at the Greek and see how significant those Greek texts are and what was said. All right. Before we begin, we do want to go to our Father in prayer. Mike, Michael, could I have you lead us in a word of prayer? Amen. Okay, so let me just pull up my Bible here. Oops. Well, that one's not going to, well, they're both not very good. Let me get a physical Bible. I drove all the way back from Stockton, and when I left today, it said the traffic was so bad from Stockton to Fresno, it said go all the way out to I-5, go all the way down to Los Banos, and come back that way. So that was a very long journey, but actually I did shave some time off the drive, which was good. I think you had mentioned that at one point. Yeah, 120 was packed. I mean, when I saw it, it was packed, so I just kept going. Except when I got to Los Banos, I'm like, Fresno, Monterey, Fresno, Monterey. It was a tough choice. Okay, so let's go back to John chapter 17. I think I have a couple of verses there that we need to finish up real quick. Okay, so if we look down at verse 24, we'll start at 24. And just look at the end of the chapter here. He says, Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, be with me where I am, so that they may see my glory, which you have given me, for you loved me before the foundation of the world. And I think we talked about that a little bit last week, because I asked the question, where is he? Now, I don't want you to answer that just yet, okay? I'm going to give you a phrase that I want you to remember when I say it again, because I'm going to say it a little bit. The phrase is ego iemi. Ego iemi. It's a Greek phrase. It's E-G-G-O, is ego, like let go of my ego. And the Emmy is E-I-M-I, the Emmy. And that's the phrase that's being used, and I want you to see why this is important, okay? So we'll go on here, and he says, O righteous Father, although the world has not known you, yet I have known you, and these have known you that you sent me, and I have made your name known to them and will make it known so that the love which you loved me may be in them and I in them. That love there that Christ has shown for the Father is in glorifying the Father, doing the will of the Father, being obedient to the Father. And then he takes that, as we've talked about before, he takes that and he shares with the people, with his disciples, that very same love for them, because he takes the words of the Father and the love that the Father has for them or for his Son and also applies that to the people. So the idea here is that there's a oneness between God and Christ, and there's a oneness between the people and Christ, so therefore there's a oneness between the people and God. And the whole purpose of this is the reconciliation of man to God. So there's no division when those are one in Christ, because we have the same love, the same adoration that the Father had for the Son is also passed on to us. And that's a beautiful thing to think about, that the same love he has for the Son is the same love he has for us. Okay? So now we're going to get into chapter 18. And if I could have somebody read the first four verses of chapter 18. Okay, so when Jesus had spoken these words, yes, sir. It should be on. Sheila, is live stream not on? Did you turn it on? Okay. So after he spoke these words, the words are the prayer that he just completed. He went forth with his disciples over the ravine of the Kidron. So this is the Kidron Valley. I want to paint a picture for you. The Kidron Valley has a brook that goes through it. From that brook, there are channels that go up the Temple Mount. At the Temple Mount, those channels go up to the altar. When they slay the lambs for the Passover, the blood goes into those channels, goes down the hill into the valley and into the Kidron Brook, turning it blood red. Okay, so I want you to understand this. Now, this is Passover. We are in Passover day, or the evening slash morning of that. And they would not have necessarily seen the blood at that point in time. But coming back across the other side, those altar Passover sacrifices would have started. And we don't know how many Passover lambs were killed on a given Passover at Jesus' death. Obviously, the most important is Jesus himself. We do know 30 years later, because there's documentation that we have of it. And the writer tells us that there were 286,000 Passover lambs that were sacrificed on the day of Passover, 30 years later. Yeah, that's a busy person. 286,000. Now, it's always hard to look at the historians and say, how accurate are you? Josephus said there were 1 million people in the city of Jerusalem when the Romans came and laid siege to the city. I don't think he went, 1, 2, 3. I would have been like, that looks like 1,000, 10,000 over there, 500,000 over here. So take it for what you will. The point is, it was so much that there was so much blood that would have been running in those channels down the side of the Temple Mount into the Kidron Brook. to cause the river itself to be satiated with the blood of the lambs. Because when Jesus comes into the city, he comes into that eastern gate. And if you look today, that eastern gate is actually blocked off. The Turks, knowing that that's where the Messiah was supposed to come through, blocked it off, and they stoned it up. And so now you can't enter from that area. But little did they know, the Messiah had already entered from that space. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So he goes, go ahead. Because they knew the Messiah was going to come from the east, and that's why they did that. Yeah. So it tells us that on the other side of the Kidron Valley, there is a garden in which he entered and his disciples. Now, what do we call this garden today? Garden of Gethsemane. Mount of Olives is the same area because it's olive trees. And when we talk about a garden, we're not talking about a little, you know, plot of land, 10 by 5, where someone's going out and done a little bit of gardening and things like that. This is a garden, which means that you can get lost in the garden. Okay? Now, this was Jesus' favorite place to go when he wanted to be in solitude. He did this in Matthew. When they all left and went to their homes, where did Jesus go? He went to the Mount of Olives, to the Garden of Gethsemane. I also want you to understand that Jesus, knowing all things and knowing, as Stephen just read, what was going to happen, he doesn't go, I think there's a ship in Joppa that goes to Tarshish. Let's head that direction. Yeah, exactly. Worked out well for Jonah. He goes to the most familiar place that who would have known he liked to go there? And Judas. So Judas is not omniscient. He's not omnipotent. I guess you could say it's the divine work of God, but if I was Judas and I wanted to lead people to Christ, I'd say, okay, where do I think he would be this night? And that's where he went. It doesn't matter whether it was by chance or by... he knew, but the question is...
Well, it says he knew because Jesus...
Often met with the disciples there, yeah. So Judas knows this, and we want to look at this. So Jesus is not running the other direction. Jesus goes to the most prominent place that he is known to go outside of the temple. He doesn't go to Bethany. Who was in Bethany? Lazarus and Mary and Martha, which would have been another place of solitude for him. But we also know that if he was there, would they have left him alone? No, they would have done what they would normally do, which is to serve him. So he goes to the garden, and he takes the disciples with him. Verse 2 tells us, as Gil just pointed out, Judas, who had already left to go take care of his business, knew the place, and when he says he knew the place, it's not that he knew the garden, because there was a big garden. He knew where Jesus would go in the garden. He knew exactly where to find him in the garden. For Jesus had often met there with his disciples. Verse 3, Judas then, having received the Roman cohort, now the word Roman is in italics, and the reason it's assumed to be the Roman cohort is because the word cohort is actually a word that Romans use. Jews did not use that word. Now, I want you, again, to see this picture here. We've got Jesus and his 11 disciples. We have Judas and a cohort, just the Roman cohort right now. Guess how many people are in a Roman cohort? 600 people. 600. Remember, Jesus is a rabbi and a teacher. and has not laid a hand on anyone in his entire ministry. But he did one thing. Overturned the money tables. Threw people out of the temple by the word of his mouth. Yo.
He also healed the sick, raised the dead, healed the lame, cured blindness. He had the power of God, and they knew that.
Right. So why did they continue to go this direction then? So 600 people, and that's just the Roman cohort. Because there's other people there too. Officers, in other words, commanders of the cohort were there. For those of the Roman, the Acts class, we talked about the Ciliarch, Claudius Lysias, right? The one who was with Paul, the one who arrested Paul or took him in to keep him away from the Jews at the time. He was a Ciliarch, and Ciliarchs were over 1,000 people. So you've got the commanders there, you've got the cohort there, and you also have officers from the chief priests. Now, this word officers is guard. It means the temple guard, the ones that were responsible to protect and provide security for those that were in the temple grounds. So they had power too, okay? And we also know of another individual that's there. Just by the way, his name is Malchus. He doesn't fit into this list per se, but he's tagging along with them. So we have the chief priest, and when it says the officers of the chief priest and the Pharisees, the chief priests were typically your Sadducees, because they were the ones responsible for the temple. These officers would have been people that would have been Sanhedrin officers, temple officers. They kind of were there for the group, okay? And they came with lanterns and torches and weapons. Now, this is interesting. I could see lanterns because it's dark. But I want to tell you something. On Passover, what was the state of the moon on Passover? It was a full moon. When you have a full moon, what do you have? Lots and lots of light, right? Hard for us because we got city lights everywhere. But we're talking Jerusalem, and we're talking the outskirts of the city on the other side of the walls, which would have been pretty dark. But you've got the moon. The moon is lighting up the place. But they come with lanterns. Okay, I get it. You got to see where you're going. Why the torches? If the lanterns are lighting the way, what are the torches for?
Scare off evil spirits,
okay. What? I'm sorry.
Emphasis.
Okay, I like that.
Defense.
It's also a way to flush him out. Think about it. You're in a garden, lots of trees, bushes. This is just my opinion. Would you think at any point in time that this person would just walk up to you and say, "Here I am"? Probably not. So the purpose of the cohort wasn't to all gather around him when he's standing there. The purpose of the cohort was, okay, spread out because we've got to find him. We've got to find where he is. We've got to take care of this massive land, and we've got to go to him. Now, the torches, I think, me personally, is if they have to sort of burn him out or get him to come a certain direction, is why the torches were there. That's just my opinion. We don't know. It doesn't tell us. But it's just interesting that there was lanterns and torches, okay? We obviously, yes? Don't know. They probably weren't all carrying lanterns. Yeah, they may have had something. We don't know, but I thought it was interesting that you had all of this stuff together. Yo.
The lantern at that point in time was obviously a gas flame that they would put some kind of a reflecting shield at the back of it
to push it out that way. Yeah.
But because it was oil fueled, the torch was cheap in comparison to
carry
an oil fueled lantern. It may be that they just didn't have enough.
It could be, yeah, yeah. the booze revenue was down that year, so yeah. Yeah. And weapons. So we know there were swords and there were clubs that they would have with them, obviously because they're expecting resistance. They're expecting a way that they need to show power and authority. Yes, sir. Yeah, they had the gladius. It's called a gladius. They had the gladius. And when you talk about the sharper than a two-edged sword, that's the two-edged sword that is being referred to. It was one that you could go this way and you could go this way, as opposed to some swords where you had to go this way and this way and this way and this way. So they were very efficient because they had it on both sides. Exactly. Okay, so verse 4. So Jesus, knowing all things that were coming upon him, what did he do? What does it say he did? Went forth. In other words, wherever he was at in the garden, he sees this going on, and he goes to them. Now, again, I'm painting this picture because he knows what's going to happen. And yet he courageously goes forth to deal with this. Right? Wow. How many times do we see Satan standing in front of us and we're ready to resolve? We're ready to attack. We're ready to defend. We're ready to go at that. Or do we see ourselves running away from those moments? Yes, sir.
How many times do we see error being taught? Or do we see people not responding as the scriptures teach us to respond? And we choose not to say anything because, oh, we're afraid to hurt somebody's feelings, or we don't like confrontation, or. It's the same dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It doesn't have to be a physical confrontation in the sense of blows and blood, and it can be other things too. Aaron.
This is the example of what you said, do not be afraid, God will always be with
you. Yeah.
So it's not, this is the do not be afraid part. This is the action of what you said. Don't be afraid. And this is how you do it.
Yeah, this is how you do it. Yeah. Iris. That's perfect, right. So he is going forth to protect his flock, to show he's ready to be that person that's going to defend them. And that's good, because that's where the questions come in, because there were, even the Romans had certain things that they had to do when they were going to arrest people. Well, we'll see that in a little bit. So we actually see that.
Well, what's interesting, it's not recorded here, but Jesus actually tells them, go sell your tunics and robes and buy swords. And they say, Master, we have two. And he says, that's plenty. Right? 600 Roman soldiers, two swords, but they have the Son of God, well, 10,000 legions of angels.
Yeah. Yeah. You raised him. I don't know. He's got a whole book, guys. He's just sermon titles by Aaron. So he goes forth to them. He meets them wherever they're at, and he says, whom do you seek? In other words, who are you looking for? So let's go 5 through 7. So if someone wants to read 5 through 7. Okay, guys, this is a lot more powerful than it looks on paper, because I want to read this to you the way the Greek looks. So Jesus, knowing all things, went forth. Whom do you seek? They answered him, Jesus the Nazarene. Okay, we'll talk about that in a minute. He said to them, he didn't say, I am he. He said, I am. Ego eimi. I am. And they all fell down from the front to the back like dominoes. Now, going to Gil's point of that emotion, this isn't, that's me, I'm here. You found me. Gotcha, you know. He, with authority and presence, says, I am. Now, what does that remind you of in the Old Testament? The name of God, Yahweh, I am. I was before, I was present, and I will be in the future. And as we talked about in my sermon, the tetragrammatical things of this, the YHWH, the Yud-He-Vav-He, when you look at the pictograms in Proto-Hebrew, is blessed cross or covenant, blessed hand. So the Yud, Hey, Vav, Hey, so the Hey is the blessed. The Yud is the covenant or the cross. I'm sorry, the Vav is the covenant or the cross, and the Yud is the hand. And that's what it looks like. That's, if you look at the pictures, that's the way it looked. We have old documents that show us this. So we're talking about, he is not telling them that I am Jesus Christ, this guy from Nazarene, which is who they're looking for. He says, I am. And I just, you know, guys, when I read that, I was like, wow, wow, I'm done. There's such presence there. There's such a story that's being told by his ability to command even through his lips. And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with him. Now, there's some significance to that. Because you see, when you stand next to a teacher or a rabbi, what are you saying? Well, not that you support them, but you're equal to them. We're on the same plane. Remember, where was Martha at? Or where was Mary at? I'm sorry. She was at the feet, right? Where was Paul at with Gamaliel? At the feet. When you were a student of a teacher, you were at the feet of your teacher. But when you're standing next to them on the same plane, Jesus the king, Jesus the priest, Jesus the prophet, Jesus the exalted one, you're standing next to him, you don't see yourself as lesser than him. You see yourself as equal, or that there's an intimacy there between you in friendship and brotherhood. And I'm going to explain how I know this here in just a minute. So Jesus the Nazarene, that's important because he needs to fulfill the prophecy, right? It can't just be Yeshua. Yeshua means Joshua. He's not the only Joshua in the entire Jewish line at this point in time. There's lots of Joshuas. So they're looking for a very specific one. We're looking for the one who is from Nazareth. And so his response is that you have found Jesus of Nazareth, or you have found the Christ, you have found I am. And they all fall down. And I wish the Bible would have gone into more details to what that looked like. I really do. I can only imagine them all standing up going, okay, let's try this again. Because that's exactly what happens. Jesus comes back again and he says in verse 7, whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth, or the Nazarene. Yes, sir.
As I read this, what I picture in my mind, they all understood those two words, I am. They knew what the Old Testament had to say when Moses said, who shall I say sent me? You tell them I am sent you. The Jews all knew this. Whether or not Romans actually knew it, speculation. Mm-hmm. But when Jesus said, I am, what I picture is the power and the authority in what he says, and in their acknowledgement and recognition of what he says, they all bowed. That's what I'm seeing in my mind.
Yeah, I wondered that too, if it was actually a forced, you know, you will bow, everybody will bow at the knee of Jesus or of Christ. Or if they fell over like a bunch of dominoes, you know, it's a hard word because it. What we do know is they were not at his height. They were not at his level.
The Jews understood.
Yeah.
And to picture them bowing doesn't shock me in the very least.
No. It just surprises me they still went through with this.
To bow before the great I am
to do what they had to do. Yep, yep. Oh, I totally agree. Oh, of course not. They're, you know, they're sleeping. It's night. You know, it's.
The Pharisees were there.
Yeah, exactly. And to the Romans, you know, to their credit, I guess you could say, they really had no skin in the game one way or the other. They were paid to go out there and do this because he was a threat. And regardless of what they saw in him, if he saw himself as a king, whether a spiritual king or an earthly king, that was a threat to the way of Roman life. And so they did have that interest, but these guys really didn't care one iota, in my opinion, that this was a man who said, I am the Son of God. Yeah, there we go again. Exactly. Because what would happen is they would, they're normally in Caesarea, so they're on Caesarea on the coast, but for the feast, they would come on over and they would hang out in the Fort Antonia, and they would have a visual of the city from that perspective, and they could see what was going on. I agree. Okay, any other thoughts? Okay, so he asked them again, whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. Okay, so Jesus isn't, I take this from what Gil said. If Jesus said, I am, you have two ways to look at that. That is the Son of God, or, okay, let's try this again. But there's something else that's going on to what Ira said. He's asking them a question from a legal standpoint. What is your warrant? What is your cause? Why are you here? And their answer twice, which is a very Jewish thing, by the way, is we're here for Jesus. And Iris, that's why he says next what he says about his disciples. Because you're not here for them. You didn't mention them. You didn't say anything about them. So we're going to deal with that a little bit differently. So he says, they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And then Jesus said, I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these go their way. So he's catching them in their own legal conundrum. I asked you twice. You said twice, you're only looking for Jesus. I told you that I am him. If not these guys, so you need to let them go because you have no charge against them. Now, Stephen, I don't know how that would look in today's world, but and there's no chocolate on the mouth or the lips. Or right.
And that's exactly what Jesus is doing here. And he gets the Romans would respect the rule of law.
Yeah. Yeah, so he is setting this up because they don't ask him who he is. And he doesn't say, well, guess, or I don't have to tell you. I don't have to show you my driver's license. You don't have legal authority for that. Am I being detained? He asked them, who are you looking for? And so he comes and he says, yes, this is me. I already told you once. I'm going to tell you again. This is me. So you have no charge against these here. And that's to your point. That's a fulfillment of prophecy also. Father, I didn't lose one of them. Yeah. So all of this is coming to a head. If you seek me, let these go their way to the fulfill the word which he spoke of those whom you have given me. I lost not one. It goes back to the prayer, right? So to the prophetic prayer. So then we have good old Simon being good old Simon, pretentious, foot and mouth, whatever you want to say, young Mr. Peter. He decides, and I thought this is interesting. He is just carrying a sword for the carrying of sword's sake, right? Drew it. Yeah, I know. But it just is funny it happened to be him carrying it. Struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear, and the slave's name was Malchus. Poor old Malchus, this is his only claim to fame, and he gets his ear cut off, okay? So Jesus said to Peter, put the sword into the sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it? What is the cup that he is to drink? What's that, Mike?
Well,
okay. The blood, right? The shedding of his blood. I sort of see it a little bit more, and maybe I'm kind of reading into it a little bit more. It's also that decision he had to make, like you talked about on Sunday. I have to lay down my life. It's something I have to do. The Father gave me the choice, the cup, and I'm having to drink it or not drink it. I'm going to drink it.
Expand that even more.
Okay.
Jesus had to make the choice. Christ had to make the choice to come down from heaven.
Right. That's true. All of that's a cup, right. That's a good point. Okay. So verses 12, so let's go to, before we do that, I want to share something. How did Judas identify Jesus himself? How did he identify Jesus? Because John doesn't go into that detail. The betrayal kiss, right? We call it the kiss of death, the betrayal kiss. I want you to understand something, and this goes back to the point I was making about his identity standing next to Christ. Slaves kissed what part of the body? The feet. Inferiors kissed what part of the body? The hands. Brethren, intimates, people that are equal to you, kiss you on the cheek. You see, it shouldn't get past us that Judas, who left to go betray Jesus, comes back, knows where Jesus is at, comes back and kisses him as if nothing's happened. We're still on good terms, right, Jesus? Yeah, exactly. Everything's okay, right, Jesus? You still see me as one of your buds, one of your brethren. Now, again, I'm not saying that that's what happened in the sense of what the thoughts were, but we know in history that a person didn't kiss you on the cheek unless you were considered to be intimate with each other as brethren. Matter of fact, Romans 16:16 tells us, salute one another with a holy kiss. The churches of Christ salute you. It's the idea that we're all equal together, right? So Judas doesn't just show up on the scene. Judas is there to make it look like he is equal, just like the other disciples. We're all in this together. The other thing that we know about that situation, Jesus, in this moment, you have Satan and God coming together to do something together, but each had a different outcome that they were looking for. God obviously was to bring victory over Satan. Satan wanted to bring victory over God. But the darkness that's there is not just the darkness that the people have come to take Jesus to the cross. It's the wrath of God coming to fruition. It's the judgment of that. It's his righteousness in its fullness coming, and all of that's going to be laid on the Son when he's up there on the cross. Because God is allowing this to take place. It is a very, very, very dark time in humanity. But talking about sermon titles, as I was thinking about this today, I thought, you have the better from the worst. In other words, the worst that man could ever be, which is to take the Son of God and place him on a cross and try to kill him, completely absolving yourself of that responsibility, completely saying that I don't believe in God, I do not believe that God exists or that God has anything to do with my life, and yet God uses that as a way to redeem man back to him. And that story has been told throughout the prophets, throughout the Gospels, throughout the letters. We hopefully still teach it today. And hopefully, as people, we understand that darkness is real, but also that victory is real as well. Because it's a dark world out there, even today. And we have to continue to see the victory in front of us, constantly see that victory in front of us. So I just wanted to bring that up because when I was studying this, I was like, you've got the marrying of these two things happening, the good of God, the righteousness of God, and the darkness of Satan coming together in the same moment. Okay, any thoughts to that? Aaron. I agree. Gil.
I try not to do this too often, but allow me a moment to wax poetically.
Please do.
Speculation. The Romans, all those coming for Jesus were carrying lanterns, they were carrying torches. It would seem to imply that Jesus and the disciples weren't sitting around a campfire or had their own torches. And so it was dark.
Mm-hmm.
And here they come with this light, and Jesus the Christ steps into the light and says, I am. And they knew what that was. I'm quite confident that that's probably not symbolic, but it just kind of stuck.
No, but I think it's good for us to not speculate, but to take what we read and try to put some visual to it. Because it makes it more real for us, right? It does for me anyway. I love history, and I love looking at old historical documents and things that, if you go to my house, I've got 1611 King James text on my wall from King James Bibles. And while that's not significant, holding that document, something that people died to make happen, is very emotional for me because of what people went through to make that occur. And that's really something that really resonates with me. So I love to think about these things because I see the humanity of our Savior in presence with his love of being the Son of God at the same time. And that's really a beautiful, poetic way of looking at it. So we'll do just a couple more verses. So the Roman cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. Okay, we obviously can get a picture of what that is. And led him to Ananias, depending on which version you have, first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. Okay, so we are going to look at next week, and I've brought this up before, but I just want to share this with you because this is an interesting family that we have in front of us. Annas, Caiaphas, Joseph. But what I will tell you is that they have found the ossuaries, the bone boxes of this family. They have uncovered it. In the 1990s, they were able to locate it by accident. And the reason they know it is because every one of them matched the names of the family that they know, and it's written on the side of the boxes. No. I will also tell you that the Jews do not see the Annas family as favorable. In the Mishnah, which is the law that Maimonides and that group came up with later on, that's where we get the 613 laws, there's actually a curse in the Mishnah towards this family because they were the ones in power from the time of Herod all the way to the time of the destruction of the temple. So guess who they're going to blame? The people that were in charge, right? So they actually look at that family as being the reason why the temple was destroyed. They still can't blame themselves for the reason why the temple was destroyed. But I hope that just looking at those first few verses, we can see the power of Christ in this, his courage, his resolve, his ability, as Aaron says, not to be timid, to show that, to show his disciples, I still love you, but I also am going to show you how to act, how to react, and I'm going to protect you as much as I can because I'm still here. There will be a point where I can't protect you and be a boundary between you physically. You're going to have to deal with that. And that's why we had chapters 13, 14, 15, and 16, because he needed to get them ready for that. Okay? So any other thoughts or comments about this part of the verse? All right. Thank you. Really appreciate your opportunity to be here. And again, as you noticed, I didn't get to any of the questions, so hopefully you can take them home and work on them tonight or this week.